Welcome to a special bonus episode of Future Makers, discussing how a change in climate could impact on what we eat. The world is getting hotter, drier, and more crowded. By 2050, there could well be 10 billion humans across the globe, while at the same time, there may be far less land suitable for growing food. There is also increasing awareness that our diet and food choices can have a significant impact on our carbon footprint. And while innovations like lab-grown foods may provide emission-friendly options, and new technologies may make our food supply more adaptable and robust, we clearly have many challenges ahead. So to put it simply, what is the future of food? Joining me today are Dr. Monica Zurek and Dr. Jim Woodhill, both from the Food Systems Group at the University of Oxford's Environmental Change Institute. Monica, perhaps we could start with a bit of an overview around food systems as a whole. What do we even mean by the term food systems, and what do they look like at the moment?
So the term food system and the use of that as an analytical tool for understanding how we are currently producing and consuming food has really evolved over the last 10, 15 years. And so it's used across basically to try to describe not just the production side of food or the consumption side, but also the middle bit. So all the different parts that actually transform the kind of crops that we produce into what we have on our plate. So that means the processing sector, the retailing sector, the storage, the transport sector. As basically over the last 50 years, our system evolved and became more and more complex with many more actors in the system. It became clear that just analyzing agriculture only or consumers was not enough. And that's where the idea about really applying systems thinking in terms of understanding this complex set of actors that now constitute what we call the system that really feeds ourselves.
Talking about a system suggests that there's a lot of unity here, that the patterns for different kinds of foods are very similar, are they?
Definitely not. I mean, if we think of fruit and vegetables, which are consumed directly in many cases, maybe just cooked, it's quite different from having a burger. Yeah, that is now considered the most important food by a lot of people, where you have a lot of processing steps in between to make the bun, to make actually the patty. And there's a whole industry behind actually supplying a burger to us as a consumer. And that requires a lot of different people coordinating with each other until you finally come to that end product that we can consume.
We're basically talking about linkages and interactions. So we're interested in the interactions and the linkages between consumers and farmers. We're interested in the linkages between food and health. We're interested in the linkages between food and food in the environment and food and people's jobs and livelihoods. And there's very challenging issues around all these issues, but also lots of opportunities. And the real challenge for us is to try and understand those linkages as best we can and not try and tackle some of the big challenges we have in a very sort of simple or linear way. And I think that whole sense of trying to take this broader systems view that enables us to get a better sense of the linkages is what's behind this story of food systems.
So does that mean when you're trying to understand food systems, there are specific features that may be in common between lots of different food systems? Yes. And so rather than looking at these as either as though they were all the same or on the other hand separating them all out, you're trying to focus on common factors that can be understood in each case.
Exactly. I mean, it starts with setting the boundary about what is the system of analysis that we are really studying. I mean, is it Oxford? Is it Oxfordshire? Is it the UK? Is it the globe? Yeah, but then within that, we basically look at who does what in the system. So the key actors, yeah, how do they relate to each other? And what basically conditions the decisions that they make within the system, because that's basically where some of these entry points for change might eventually be. And then what are the outcomes of the system? And right now we see we have neither the food and nutrition security outcomes that we want. We have a lot of very strong environmental impacts of the food system, not just in the climate space, but also around biodiversity, water use, nutrient cycling, and so on. And we don't have the economic or the equity outcomes that we want from the system. So basically, this approach should enable us to find different solutions than what we had before, where we targeted one part of the system, you know, change consumer behavior, change agricultural practices, all of that, because we know of the relationships need to go
right
together.
So we need to think of these things as a system rather than trying to tackle each separately. Thank you. OK, I've got a grasp then of the kind of problem space. Jim, can you tell us a bit about the current trends in policy, markets, consumption, the food systems generally?
There's one figure that really strikes me every time I think around this. And as if you look at the amount of fresh fruit and vegetables we produce, it's well under half what we should be eating to have a healthy diet, according to, for example, the Harvard Healthy Eating Plate. So if we just think about our overall human health, what we produce versus what we should be eating is completely out of balance. So that's just one issue we need to think about.
And is that getting better or is it getting worse?
That's probably getting worse. And if we look at issues like obesity, I mean, that's now hitting something like 40%. It's rising very rapidly in many emerging economy countries. So the consequences of that for public health, for the costs of public health, are just horrendous if we start to look 10, 20, 30 years down the track. I mean, at the same time, we still have around about a third of the global population with micronutrient deficiencies. So there is just this really big imbalance in getting nutrient right. And those issues are on top of the fact that we still have 800 million people or so that basically go to bed hungry each night. So, you know, just in terms of getting ourselves fed right, we've got some really big issues in the global food system that we need to try and tackle. And then we can take you into the other two dimensions of this that we often talk about. One is, of course, the environment and climate dimension, where there's a whole range of issues we can explore. And the other dimension is, you know, many of us in the world earn our incomes from producing, distributing, selling food, particularly in countries with emerging economies, where something like 60% of people are involved in food systems in some way or other. And the very large bulk of the very poorest people in the world are also involved in agriculture and food issues. So if we want to tackle poverty and inequality, the whole food system again becomes a critically important thing to look at around these big global development issues. And if you take all of this into a slightly bigger context, if you look at any of the sustainable development goals and put food systems at the centre there, they are all highly dependent on the way we think about food systems and both the opportunities and the challenges in the food system.
Right. But are food systems worldwide changing at the moment significantly? In which direction? In the same way? Or is it pretty random?
I think you can see some big trends, but I think there are some very big differences between, let's say OECD countries and low and middle income countries. So in OECD countries, we have tremendous consolidation into a limited number of supermarket chains and distributors of food. If you look at low and middle income countries, you still have a much more diverse food systems with wet markets, with a lot of small and medium enterprises in a much more diverse sort of system. So while supermarkets are starting to emerge in lower and middle income countries, it's not quite like the way it is in OECD countries.
Right, but is it a matter of a trend in a constant direction, but some countries are going faster than others?
To a degree, but I think we've got decades
right
before we see the sort of same patterns that we have, you know, here in the UK and the way the food system works than what you will see in India or Indonesia or in many countries in Africa. But yes, there is a general direction in that. I mean, I think what is really interesting behind all of this is to understand that the way food supply has changed over the last sort of 10, 20 years around urbanisation. So, you know, you're seeing thousands of percent increase in terms of food being transferred from the countryside to growing urban populations in many parts of the world, which has led to a phenomenal increase in small and medium enterprises involved in the food sector.
Right. So if we had, as it were, business as usual, we could imagine continued change in that sort of direction with countries, as it were, following the leader, following through the same patterns of development that have occurred elsewhere, but perhaps more rapidly.
I think this is a really interesting question. I mean, how quickly that's going to happen. I mean, if we consider that in OECD countries, there's just a few percentage of people involved in agriculture, for example. Whereas in low-income countries, it's still sort of 50-60% for many, and in middle-income countries, it's 30-40%. I don't think that number of people involved in agriculture is going to drop down to the couple of percent in the very near future.
Okay,
so there is a reality of very, very large numbers of people being involved in food systems in many countries that we have to take on board in how we think about the evolution of food systems.
Right, that's a very interesting point. So there's no way that, as it were, countries that are evolving now can evolve at the speed you might expect. It's going to take generations, perhaps, because of the changes in it implies for the economy, for working practices and social changes.
Right. Also, where would, for example, the people that are getting out of agriculture? I mean, when we had the Industrial Revolution, a lot of these people were taken up by the industrial sector. You saw a similar trend in a lot of South Asian and Asian countries where the increase in manufacturing sector would take up a large amount in the last, 30, 40 years of people coming from the countryside. Sub-Saharan Africa, you don't necessarily yet have the places where this type of the population would go to. And you need also the educational background to train people for other parts of the economy. So as Jim was saying, there is definitely a large question of how this part of the system will evolve. Let me maybe add one other interesting fact into that whole mix. This is why the whole idea about food system transition becomes so complex, is that what we have seen in terms of dietary change over the last 10, 12, 20 years is overall, though, a bit more the direction towards a homogenization of diets. So in Asia, it's called the westernization of Asian diets. So
Is this because of commercial pressures, largely advertising and so on?
That might be one area. It's also, people becoming much more aware of what else you can eat. So a lot of the regional diets evolving, for example, from rice towards more wheat-based, have a toast in the morning instead of having rice porridge, At the same time here, it's now everybody knows what an avocado is and wants to have an avocado on toast in the morning, which was something that people in Central America and Mexico were eating for hundreds of years. Here it was a novelty until 10 years ago,
Right.
And the question is what that kind of homogenization in terms of dietary demands, also for a healthy diet, might do to pull food systems, because we know that currently the way of how, we've structured ourselves through small number of supermarket chains and purchasing agencies, controlling a bit how the system works to a certain extent. So the question is, that gives the consumers a much bigger power than ever before we had in human history, because it was in human history, people would eat what a farmer could produce within a particular area. And that has definitely changed in the way of how we are now feeding ourselves and what we are demanding. So the question of what does it mean if all we know already, if a lot more people want to have a meat-based diet in lower income countries because of rising incomes, we know that might be potentially, we know that is a problem on the environmental side of the food system.
Yes, I want to come to the environment very shortly. I mean, it's evidently a very complex issue even before we throw changes in the climate into it.
Yes.
Because globalization and what you've said about the changes in demand. I mean, on the one hand, it makes more people demand a more varied diet. But on the other hand, it homogenizes in the sense that people around the world are looking for the same varied stuff. I mean, presumably that brings some pressures in terms of specialization, does it?
I think there's two things happening. On one hand, you get this sort of, I guess, niche demand for the avocados and the strawberries that I notice in the middle of winter we can still buy here in the supermarket. On the other hand, you also get this sort of shift towards a very high nutrient, flour based, if you like, diet that is essentially very energy rich and nutrient
makes
nutrient
us all
weak. Being blunt about it, yes, exactly. that's another big trend that you see happening. Historically we had a much bigger diversity of grains and products and fruit and vegetables that were often eaten in different cultures. So I think we also need to be careful about oversimplifying different regions. So if you look at what's happening in Africa versus Asia versus Latin America, I mean, there are still very, very big differences. And that's, we've just produced a report on the future of small-scale agriculture, and that's been one of our really key messages, is you've got to understand what's happening in a particular local context. And for example, at the moment, a very big proportion of those who are really suffering extreme hunger are in fragile states and states with conflict. So again, you've got to understand that wider political context that sits around these issues as well.
Yeah, and presumably that's disruptive both to local farming, but incredibly disruptive to supply chains.
Absolutely.
Yeah, quite apart from what it does to poverty and so forth. Yeah. Okay, can we bring the climate into it? How does climate and broader environmental change as well feed into this? I mean, it sounds that it's already a very complex story. That's going to make it even more complex.
My bottom line around all of this always is, on the one side, the food system and the way of how we are producing food, but also, you know, transporting, cooling food, consuming, cooking, sits at the heart of a lot of the environmental changes that we currently see around the globe. You know, a third of global greenhouse gas emissions come from the sector.
A third.
Depending on the specific...
Is that cows?
Not
is
just
it transport.
Of that around third, you know, around 30% come from ruminants, from cows and sheep, and you know, the ones with the four stomachs and the methane that they produce.
Yeah.
Then there is, of course, also quite a bit from on-farm energy consumption. Yeah, but then at least 15-16% comes from methane emissions from rice production, which...
Sorry, was that rice,
15 to 16% is estimated,
right,
to come from methane emissions from rice production. And then, of course, we also have quite a bit of emissions from fertilizer, NOx emissions, basically, that contribute quite substantially as a greenhouse gas as well. So these are the key sources, basically, of emissions. But... almost 70% in many countries, even more dry countries, of global freshwater resources are used in irrigation systems. Right now, a lot of land use change driven by agricultural expansion drives the loss of biodiversity quite heavily. Global nutrient cycling for nitrogen and for phosphorus are really overstretched. We're putting on way too much nitrogen and phosphorus, which then ends up either in the air or in our streams and then in our oceans. So we have a huge issue around pollution. So yeah, there's definitely something that we need to do. But let me say, at the same time, and then I'll finish here, is agriculture and the way of how we produce food is also going to be really impacted by a lot of these changes. So it's a two-way street that we see and that we don't take into account enough.
Let me make the problem even a little bit more complicated, because the projections are that we probably need somewhere around 60% more food produced by 2050 to meet the demands of a growing population and growing middle class who are going to want...
60% more?
More, 60%
but
more.
There's notoriously a lot of food wastage, right? And as you said, we're eating too much. Suppose we were all... to become sensible eaters and careful rather than wasteful.
Well, exactly. So this is, you know, if you like, this is where we need to have the philosophical conversation. I mean, how do we tackle this? So that's sort of a projection, saying that if you take the sort of diets that you see people eating at the moment as they get richer, and we're eating some of the sort of levels of meat that are commonly eaten in the West, these are the sort of projections that one might expect. So obviously, you've got a number of ways that you can tackle this problem. So yes, one is to reduce waste. Another one is to change what you eat, and another one is to try and produce what you produce more efficiently. So there's different sort of slices of how you can maybe try and tackle this problem. But the way we're heading at the moment is, yes, we're going to need to produce 60% more food. And if we're already producing a third of greenhouse gases with what we're producing at the moment, you can imagine what that means for increased greenhouse gases. And you don't have to be a mathematician to work out that 60% more of the 70% water we're already using is over 100%. There's a few challenges in all of this. But I think... that's sort of taking some projections about how we might see things evolving. But I think there's a few sort of other rabbits in the hat, if you like. that are about shocks to the system, which are the uncertainties. So, you know, we know that as we get climate happening, it has a big impact on disease outbreaks and the nature of disease outbreaks. So, you know, issues like extreme weather events, droughts, floods, unpredictable diseases all start to bring shocks onto the system. And so if you've got a system that's already rather vulnerable because you're pushing it to the extreme and then you load that with additional shocks, then yes, you do have a potentially very problematic situation. And we saw that all come together to some degree around the 2007-08 food price crisis, where, you know, prices for some commodities virtually doubled. And there's very strong evidence now about the linkages between those very high food prices and political instability in many countries. Which, you know, which we can get onto how that then flows back into a whole lot of thinking about food security and policy making in many countries as well.
There are obviously lots of problems here. Are there any hopeful signs?
Well,
of course.
Yeah. I mean, I think like many things, we've got a pretty good idea what we can do and what we need to do. So, you know, at one level, yes, we probably all need to be changing our diet a bit to make it a little bit more environmentally sensitive, or a lot more environmentally sensitive. And there's a lot of arguments around that, you know, you probably don't need to cut all your meat out, but having a substantially more plant-based diet is one of the directions. As you've already mentioned yourself, Peter, you know, trying to dramatically reduce food loss and waste is a very good opportunity. There's all sorts of ways we can try and improve efficiency in the system. We'll come to some of the technology, but I mean, you know, often we go and spray fields with large amounts of pesticide. You now have robotics and even artificial intelligence systems and so on that can put much more micro doses to reduce that sort of pressure.
Exactly where they're needed,
exactly
rather than scattering them over the whole field.
Scattering them all over the
place. And is that actually being used a lot?
Oh, it's starting to be used in some places. I mean, I think we still have a big diversity between, you know, high-tech agriculture and sort of lower tech agriculture in many parts of the world, and that does bring a complication, because if you want many people who are currently involved in smaller scale agriculture to be involved, and you try and push it to very very high tech capital intensive, then you've got big questions about what you do with the labour. So again, coming back to these sort of systemic interactions, that's something to think about.
Yeah, but it comes to spraying crops, though, that doesn't not use many people, right? Somebody in a small plane or something like that, or
not even. I mean, a lot of the precision agriculture is really now trying almost to go down to the plant level and look at what they need in terms of nutrients and pesticides and
sure.
And things
I mean,
like
what I was suggesting was that getting rid of the person who's spraying a whole field in a plane is not putting lots of people out of business. But I imagine the big obstacle will be economic, in that, although there's a cost to the chemicals, there's also a cost to the little robots that are going to go around putting the things just where they're needed. Is that right?
Well, there's partly that. But, I mean, let's remember that there are about 500 million small-scale farmers in the world. Right. And a lot of those farmers produce the food that's consumed in lower and middle-income countries, you know, something sort of up towards 70%. So there's a huge
70%.
Yeah. So there's a huge number of people involved in producing food in low and middle income countries, and that's their livelihood. So what I think we have to be thinking around all of this, if we want to basically get the three wins from our food systems, creating good jobs and income for as many people as possible, producing as healthy food as possible, and doing it with environmental limits, we've got to think about how these things interact. So using technology in a way that creates economic and employment opportunities for those very large numbers of people involved in the food system is one of the things we need to be trying to think about and consider.
Well, and of course, combine that with the kind of technical change that we might need to incentivize here in a lot of northern countries around, you know, things like precision agriculture, you know, early warning systems, you know, very specific AI robotic technologies. But on a lot of them, the verdict is still out, how they might work and what they will contribute. But
do you mean whether they'll be reliable, whether they'll do the job?
No, or... I think there's, I mean, in terms of just technology, there's a lot out, yeah, that people are starting to use. But the question is who at the end benefits from it. As Jim was saying, is also, for example, the use of blockchain technology in tracing food now across the food. I mean, a small farmer is not easily able, even a small farmer within the UK, yeah, it's a huge capital investment, and it's a high risk they're taking to go down that path. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how can we bring the kind of technologies that we might need to make them applicable across a wide range of farmers? This is what we haven't really figured out.
That's what I was wondering with regard to the precision application of pesticides. Just to give one example, if you've got clever robots that can do that, but the farmers can't afford to buy the robots to do it, then you've got a problem, right? So, I mean, what do we need? Philanthropists who are going to mass produce these things on such a scale that they become cheap enough for people to use, or what?
Well, some technology is actually quite cheap as well. So I think that we're starting to see, you know, really good examples of where, for small-scale agriculture, technology is being used, where you've got an app. Historically, you might have had a local fertilizer provider in a village. Who's not giving terribly good advice to the farmer, but now he's got all the information he needs about what sort of level of fertiliser you need, how you get better application of pesticides on if you're using those, how to get the right seeds, and can provide that information very easily to a small-scale farmer. A farmer can get access to prices and information themselves. So there's a lot happening in this space very rapidly that is actually improving the situation for many.
What nevertheless though will be very interesting in all that aspect is basically the use of data and who owns the data. And who controls this type of data, yeah? And that's also when we move towards precision agriculture, robotics, as well as using them, you know, for small-scale farmers' information. I mean, who produces, for example, the weather data that the farmers might need, or the pest data, in order to understand better when and how to spray? And does the farmer who supplies data to any kind of organization owns them or not? Yeah, and so what's the use of big data for precision agriculture and so on and so forth? What's that going to do, and how the control mechanism for this work? This, I think, is something that we definitely should work out.
That's getting back to some issues actually that we discussed quite a lot in the previous series of Future Makers on AI. Yeah. Can you just enlarge though a little bit on how, I mean, with regard to the use of our data, there are familiar sort of dangers when it comes to personal data, and, you know, data about our political or sexual or whatever other preferences. How does data about the weather feature as something that might be exploited in a negative way by big companies?
Well, I mean, the question is, who then controls who gets the data?
Well, is there any harm in just making it available to everybody?
No, there shouldn't be. And I mean, right now, that's basically what you know, a lot of public extension services and also a lot of private extension services
right.
are doing. The thing is more like, what else do you need in order to be able to access the data? So if it comes, let's say, as Jim was saying, from private, you know, the fertilizer companies that also give you advice, which now, because in a lot of countries, public extension services have been slashed and burned.
Right.
Yeah. If now you only get the information if you're also buying the fertilizer with
yes.
that company,
yeah, sure.
that's then where the problem starts.
And also, presumably, if they control the data, that there is a risk that some unscrupulous companies might tell you the data that suits them and yeah. encourages you to buy the product, right?
And on the other hand, there are very positive things of how this can work. So, you know, if you automatically, when you buy your seed, buy an insurance for your crop if you don't get enough rain for it, and then you have remote sensing, and this is already happening, that if through remote sensing it's clear there hasn't been enough rainfall for your crop to generate, then you automatically get a payment into your bank account as a small farmer for crop insurance. So those sorts of systems start to show, you know, how you can really help at a local level with farmers.
And those are actually happening.
They're absolutely happening.
And are they being pushed by governments or what?
I mean, initially they were pushed fairly much by development organisations, but I mean, I think now the sort of economics of them are starting to evolve. So quite a number of financial institutions are very involved in this sort of micro insurance type system that, you know, is a very good example of how you then try to create more resilience to the pressures of climate change.
And it's working in a benign way, is it, where the financial institutions benefit because they've got customers who are financially healthy, and it works for the good of everybody, doesn't
it? Exactly, yeah.
Excellent. Yep. The invisible hand at work.
Farming is really, as it should. And I mean, one of the key risks for farmers is the weather.
Yeah. But I think just coming to that point, I think we have an enormous number of really positive examples of all the sorts of things that can be done. And our colleagues actually gave us a whole sheet here of a huge range of different technologies that can be deployed into this.
Do you want to read some of them out?
Well, yeah, sure. So it's around digital agriculture on improved foresights. It's drones, it's robotics, it's blockchain, it's modelling systems and how they work. It's micro irrigation, it's vertical horticulture and aquaponics. Precision farming, as we were talking about in terms of robotics. It's completely rethinking the circular processes. It's understanding
soil nutrients.
What do
you mean by circular processes?
Well, it starts with that thinking in a system that you don't want to have waste. I mean, the waste is used for something else. So you can think of circular system, and it's translated into circular economy ideas around recuperating phosphorus, for example, from the system.
So everything goes around a circuit rather than being dumped.
Exactly. If we go to the consumption end, nutrigenics, where you start to get a much better understanding about exactly what sort of nutrients does an individual need and tailoring your diet to that. So I think the way I think about it is the big issue is how do you get the incentives in place for all of these good examples to go to a scale that tackles the problem? You know, and there we have to come back and understand some of the fundamentals. You know, unfortunately, we still have some big market externalities that don't drive the system in the right way. So what is it we need to do to get the incentives in place to shift these things in a better direction? And globally, we know that something in the order of $600 billion is spent on subsidies for agriculture. Now, at the moment, those subsidies are largely disconnected from thinking about health and environment and so on. It was really about just driving production.
And helping industries, presumably.
And helping industries, yeah. So how do you think about sort of redirecting those sorts of things to actually get a better sort of win-win-win around some of these sorts of issues? And now that, in the end, really probably requires bringing people together in dialogue and discussion and getting the linkages between business and government and civil society and farmers and so on to really say, now, how do we think all of this through? How do we start shifting the system, getting the right incentives in place in ways that can work for all? I mean, without being naive that everything is always going to benefit everybody, because it's probably not. There are going to be some trade-offs that we're going to have to work out and deal with those trade-offs.
Let's also not be naive about humanity's ability to all come together and find great solutions through rational discussion. I mean,
this is coming back to the whole idea of really using a systems lens to analyzing these problems, but also finding solutions. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key things that definitely has changed is that there is now a much greater sense of urgency of why maybe we need a different type of dialogue than what we had before to really transform the system. Yeah, and that has to do, of course, with the climate and environmental crisis, and it has majorly to do with the health outcome out of the system that Jim mentioned and that we currently see. So I think there is, for me, there's kind of a window of opportunities opening up slowly, where we see, I mean, it's we need transformation, and what we are arguing is the more coordinated and the more integrated it can be across the different actors, and also starting to develop a common vision of where with the food system you might want to go. That's probably the quickest way forward than trying to experiment and tinker on different parts of the system without understanding how these changes might work in terms of really transforming the system.
That's interesting. I mean, as a philosopher who knows a little bit about complex systems and so on, I can't help feeling a little bit sceptical. When you've got a very complex system, actually, you may have a better understanding of very little things within it than understanding of how it all fits together and exactly which levers are going to be positive and which negative.
I mean, this gets into a sort of very deep discussion, if you like, which is fascinating about systems and how systems change and the degree to which as a society we can be sort of adaptive and responsive to future risks as opposed to waiting until and we get hit by problems. But I think there's a couple of basic systems principles. And one is, I think if we can get more people understanding where is sort of a common goal. So it's not that you're trying to engineer the whole system to work in a particular way, but you're trying to get enough people to think, actually, this is the direction overall we maybe should be trying to go, and everybody independently tends to work in that direction. And I think the other
You get people trying out lots of different things.
Trying out lots of things in that direction.
And lots of information so that things that work are spread quickly. And
it's connected and it's somehow integrated. There's a dialogue around this because you have you can build this common vision of where you want to go. And also, you know, it might be you're trying things out in a smaller sense, but at a systems level and not just in the agriculture bit or the consumer bit.
So you're looking at the effects on other parts of the system.
Exactly. And with that, you then move forward. So the approach that we're working on also in our group, in the food systems group, is that on the one side, you need the ability to assess where the system, how the system looks like. Yeah. What is it, as we talked before, but also in terms of metrics, where do we know what the where the system outcomes currently stand? And then you can think about the visioning, you know, as Jim was saying, and thinking, okay, if we don't have the outcomes in our system that we are looking at, how can we in a more coordinated way think about direction of travel? And that then needs to be translated, as Jim was also saying, basically back into what would I as a food processor now do different in terms of working with the farmer. But the point is, there is already this understanding we are part of this larger system, and the way of how I might be changing might be impacting the other actors in a particular way. Yeah. So what we've seen, for example, here in a project on the fresh fruit and veg system for the UK, is that the way of how some actors try to build resilience to water scarcity in the system is undermining the ability of other actors to do the same.
Right.
Yeah. Because the risk is perceived differently. So that's why the strategies are differently. So if the retailer diversifies in his supplier base versus the farmer trying to get enough capital together to build an irrigation system, to be smarter about water use, then and they are not talking, which is what's not happening.
So the farmer is losing money because the customer is diversifying. Well, so the farmer can't afford to build the irrigation system.
Yes. So what we've seen is that the farmer, as a measure, tries to build a different type of irrigation system, which requires a certain set of capital resources over a long time. If he only gets these very short-term contracts because the retailers don't want to have basically these long-term commitment. They want to be able to diversify if they need to quickly, you know, then basically the system doesn't work in terms of eventually supplying apples, British apples, to British consumers or versus apples that come from South Africa.
But I can see a bit of a risk here, though. Tell me if I'm wrong. That this could have a perverse effect, because the person looking at the farmer and wondering how much they can afford to depend on that farmer may use exactly the reasoning you've just given to say, oh, I see, there's a bit of a risk here. This farmer might lose out from other customers. And even if I support the farmer longer term, my money may be, down the tubes because the farmer's going to go bust anyway or not be able to finish the irrigation system. So highlighting fragilities in the system could have the perverse impact of undermining the security of the least secure, could it?
Absolutely. And I think, this is one of the challenges for food, and particularly on the production side, is the risks are very big and climate change is bringing further risks.
So don't you have to bring governments or international organisations in here? You can't rely on the market.
You can't rely purely on the market. And I think, I quite like Ulrich Beck's work where he talks about risk society. And I think one of the challenges we still have with our government systems is we haven't worked out how to get our governance mechanisms to work in a way that tackle risk properly and that tackle these huge externalities that we're coping with something like the food system. And, I think as...
Can you just clarify, when you say externalities, of weather and so on?
Well, no, I guess what I'm thinking about is, if you've got food companies producing fairly low quality food that makes us all obese and sick, they don't end up having to cover the cost when we go to hospital. So that's the classic externality, you know, the pollution that goes into the river and has an environmental thing. Right. So we're talking
not
about all those.
So not the problem for the economic actors, and so they ignore it.
Exactly. And so we haven't found a way to, you know, really properly price in the cost to the environment and the cost to our human health of the way that the food systems are working, which means, yes, you've got to have government stepping in there and working. But I think you've got to try and work out systems in a dialogue and a collaboration with other actors. And I think, you know, many in the private sector are seeing, you know, the need for very big changes in the way they do business. Yeah. But that also requires that to be complemented with changes in the way government mechanisms work. You know, as I was talking about in the example of the way, for example, you know, subsidies in the agriculture system work.
And how far are things going in this direction? I mean, our governments taking serious note of these imperatives.
In the UK, we now have all the consultation around a food policy versus purely an agriculture policy. Yeah. So there is already, you know, consultation across all kinds of different people in the system to a certain extent that the government is currently having around. Do we need a food policy or do we want an agriculture policy? Actually, the same is happening on the EU level to a certain extent. So in the EU, we were part of a system that of a project that looked at, you know, sustainable, as it's called, sustainable food and nutrition security. And the idea was, do we need really a food system or a food policy that looks across these different actors, brings in some of these aspects? Or is it enough that we change part of the common agriculture policy? So,
but probably nobody will be surprised that Europe is near the head of the pack on these things. But what's it like in the rest of the world?
Varied. I think in countries with lower and middle income countries, these issues are so critical to the issues they're facing in their country that there is certainly rapidly growing attention around them. You know, if I think about my own country, Australia, I mean, the current drought, of course, has really, you know, combined with the bushfires, has given a lot of cause for thought about how do you cope with these sorts of pressures and what are the implications for farming and how do you take a more integrated perspective.
Yeah, but we also know in Australia that you've got politicians who deny climate change and actors in the system who have very strong economic incentives to avoid taking certain types of action.
We do. And I guess, you know, in the end, this is all sort of a little bit of the rough and tumble of how societies change, isn't it? And, you know, and I think all you can do is get more and more actors that are seeing the problems, seeing the challenges, bringing that to the fore. Yeah. And I think as, you know, as academics and scientists in this, what we have to do is try and help put the best information on the table, make that visual, make it engaging, help wider society to understand what these issues are, what the risks are, but very importantly, what are the opportunities and what are the practical ways you can actually make a difference. And, you know, I guess one can only just assume over time this is going to change. It's going to have to change one way or another. So,
is there a general consensus about the need for this kind of systems thinking amongst academics?
I would say we're getting there. I mean, our group and, you know, John Ingram, our fearless leader, was one of the first ones to really use the term in that way and has worked on it for the last 15 years in different ways, form or shape. I've also in my background done quite a bit more of food systems thinking. I think this understanding of that the food system is really a system and it's not just here the farmers and the consumers go there and buy everything on farm or grow it even themselves. I mean, we're clear, we're way past that. And the understanding that this is has evolved into this very complex net of actors and that requires different way of looking for solution. I think that, I mean, you see the term food system now used everywhere where before people used agriculture. Right. If they're doing food systems, if they're applying it, because it's more difficult, that's definitely, but I would say it's going in the direction. What's going hand in hand with this also, I think, is the development of new tools and methodologies and approaches to really implement that thinking into ways of making it actually applicable.
And when you say tools. Do you mean software? Do you mean economic systems or what? All sorts.
Kind of a whole, I mean, approach, when I talk about approaches, in our case, we're using a set of steps, as I said before, around assessing the system, understanding what's part of the system, using foresight methodologies to think with actors and stakeholders about what are possible ways forward, using then modeling tools to help us explore both the system interactions as well as understanding the implication of different plausible futures.
And presumably scenarios. There's quite a wide range of plausible future scenarios.
That is what we are building together with the stakeholders and together with a lot of modelers then to use that as a tool to kind of understand or explore what we call the uncertainty space, but also try to find a set of robust solutions that might maybe work under a lot of different settings. And then again, it's about this implementation. What does it then mean for the individual actors and monitoring? Are we really getting the outcomes at the end that we want? So there's more and more of these tools developing now. That's where I think we can bring the best of system and complex systems thinking into more the policymaking space eventually.
But I do think there's still some gaps, because you asked about, you know, our academics and the science world thinking in a systems way. And I think very often they think in a systemic way, but I think a lot of the incentives, again, are often for more of a disciplinary approach. So I think there needs to be...
You mean in academic progression?
Academic, okay.
Is that what we're talking about? It's easier to publish if you're within a particular discipline.
Exactly, and I think a lot of money around that. So I think around these issues, there's a huge need for, you know, what I would call synthesis science. Because a lot of these things need to bring the different bits together. And that has to happen through dialogue. It has to happen through funding that enables that. But then that also needs to be coupled with better communication and better visualization and bringing all of this together. So that, again, that's some of the sort of work we're trying to do with the Foresight for Food and the Foresight work. And
when you talk about visualization, is that like producing computer models with visual output so that people can get an intuitive understanding of things?
It's partly that sort of thing. So it's making things that often just are not very visible to people more visible so they can understand what it means. And if I go back to some of the work that I did in Australia a long time back, we had big problems with salinity in the irrigation areas. Yeah. And somebody came up with the idea of putting flags all along the roads that would go up as the water table rose and created a bigger problem for salinity. Wow. And suddenly people, it all became real for them. So something that was under the ground was made visual and observable and got people talking about it. So I think, you know, how do we connect our scientific understanding to the ways of getting the society talking about these things, society engaged, and you know, if you like, trying to put in place better processes of, you know, what I would call societal learning.
Right. And I mean, where do you see things going in the future? We've talked about, you know, what needs to be done and ways of doing it, but suppose you had to predict in where things will be in 20 or 30 years time, how different they'll be from now, what would be your assessment?
Oh wow, you really want the crystal ball out.
Okay.
I hope it's a bit more reliable than a crystal ball.
Well, you know, can we talk multiple futures at least?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Yes?
Yeah,
which
sure.
Which is our scenario planning bit, you know?
We've sort of talked about three scenarios of how you could see things going broadly in the report that I talked about earlier. So, and this is also some work that's been done by the Food and Agriculture Organization. But so one is a business as usual type strategy, and we've talked a lot about what would be some of the problems going down that route. I think another possible scenario is sort of more of a divided society where those with money and wealth actually manage to protect themselves, at least in the short term, from some of the more undesirables we've been talking about. And then I think the other one is actually where we do manage to kick ourselves into a much more sustainable, equitable pathway. And I think a lot of the ways to get there are clear. And we've got to really try and build the coalitions for change to hopefully push things more in that direction than the other two scenarios, which I would see much less desirable.
Yeah, and presumably ultimately less desirable for everybody, I take it. Even the second scenario where you get rich and poor, right?
It's maybe good for a while, but it's...
Yeah, you can't have half the world starving and remain unimpacted by it, right, in all sorts of ways.
Plus now we've reached a lot of we're starting to come towards some of these planetary boundaries that people have defined. Yeah, and we know that.
Can you give some examples?
So there is this whole idea that was developed by Will Steffen and Jørn Rockström of these 9 planetary boundaries around biodiversity loss, climate issues, nutrient cycling, and so on. And I think with some of them, I mean, with climate change and also with biodiversity loss, we might be coming close to some of these tipping points in the system. We don't know exactly where they are, but we know that they will impact us a lot if we go over certain tipping points.
So we might start getting dramatic change.
Exactly.
I mean, dramatic so, even by the standards of the change
yeah,
we've already seen.
So what I'm trying to see is even the rich will not be able to insulate themselves from a lot of these changes. Yeah. Yeah? And or not even with a very high-tech technology to do this, because it will really impact a lot of our life support systems. This is, again, where part of the urgency comes from for change in the wider system. So,
I mean, I think we... No, in practical terms, I think for sure we're going to see more of a shift towards more plant-based diets, yeah. And there's a whole lot of technology around that. I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether the degree to which maybe some novel foods come online. So we've been asking synthetic meat or sea or large production of seaweed or large production of algae. So might that completely change our patterns of land use? I think for sure, or insects. Yeah, you ask what will be in your lunchbox in 20 years' time, and so you know maybe a chocolate coated cricket.
Oh right.
Together with a 3D cookie that is made out of a paste which has all the nutrients that you're supposed to eat.
Oh right.
But
tasty and everything, but
you get the paste from your local pharmacy where your GP told them what should be in the paste for you specific versus your wife.
Yeah. So it could, you know, who knows? I mean it could be that our agriculture as we understand today becomes almost a niche product, and you have more sort of, you know, mass produced factory type food but is potentially healthy and meeting your requirements. I mean, I don't think we really have the answers to that, but I think we know the sort of directions that we want to be trying to nudge things towards. I think certainly we're going to find ways of reducing the amount of food loss and waste we have. I think certainly we're going to find ways of producing agricultural products much, much more efficiently. I think we will for sure see ways of getting people onto a more healthy diet trajectory. That just has to happen.
And maybe also we might want to rethink how the current system and its structures work. For example, there's a push towards reconnecting the consumer end with the farmer end through tracing technologies, building trust again between you and the farmer by getting your your veggie boxes every day, by changing the interactions that you might have with the farmer and the sheep that stands on the farmer's ground. So really changing some of these relationships that we now have in the system. What would happen if all of the fruit and veg that you would eat as a normal consumer would come directly from the farm and you don't buy it in a shop anymore?
Well, that's going to mean it comes locally, right?
Could be, yes.
But lots of people actually rather enjoy being able to get food from around the world and those strawberries in the winter, and so forth.
But that then means also we need to think about the type of diet we have. So I personally think, if you are trying to eat more local in terms of, more seasonal in terms of your food, not just local, you might be actually ticking a lot of the boxes around some of the foods that we might want to see in the future.
Right, yeah? Okay. And what about the implications for the farmers in the areas where currently lots of the population are on the land, and some of the changes that we've talked about are probably going to mean fewer of them or working very differently? Is that right?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no doubt that there has to be a pretty fundamental transformation in what's happening in small-scale agriculture. So our recent work has suggested that you've got very, very large numbers of farmers, maybe 70% of the 500 million small-scale farmers who are less than a hectare. Now, try making a living for your family that gives you good health and good education out of that area of land. Now, that's not universally the case, but mostly that's pretty difficult. So we have to find alternatives. So some of that is going to be having slightly larger land holdings. It's going to be maybe combining off-farm income earning with on-farm income earning. It's going to be, as economies develop and you get, you know, alternative jobs in the wider economy, there's going to be have some shift. So I think the big challenge there is to manage that transition in an equitable way, because the last thing we want to do is have a whole lot of people in high levels of poverty and surviving agriculture as a livelihood of last resort.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it actually going to involve, in order to do it in anything like the time, a fundamental change in the economic system towards those people? I mean, you can't actually require that they earn a livelihood, can you?
Absolutely. We really are going to have to think very deeply about that. And I think that so looks at...
Fundamental, we're going to have redistribution, right, without them earning their keep, or at least
certainly
fully earning their keep.
Certainly. For some groups, I think the whole idea about social protection mechanisms that make sure that people have an income and have food security, we're going to have to think about how we do that for those who don't have it. Again, the circumstances here vary tremendously, whether you're talking about Africa or Asia or different parts of Asia. So there's huge country differences in what all of this means into the future. I think in Africa, for example, the degree to which you get broader economic growth is going to have huge implications on the capability of governments to manage that transition and have the resources to invest in tackling these sorts of problems.
And let me maybe add that is of course also coupled with kind of rethinking of what the role of a farmer on the land should be or could be.
You mean looking after the land rather
exactly than... So in terms of actually the whole question around payments for ecosystem services and land managers, and in a particular way that could be then the new stream of income for the actual people that remain in the land, which to a certain extent we also see it already here in the north. But I think, again, you know, we need to have these kind of discussions. What happens with the people that, for whatever reasons, will not be part of that change or transition? Because, I mean, for a lot of farmers also, I mean, it's in the farming culture, I mean, they see themselves as a business. It's not that they don't see themselves as a land manager, but they see themselves as selling something and wanting to be valued for selling this. Yeah. And so the question is it the food that they sell, or is it the ecosystem, whatever, carbon storage or flood protection, but actually being valued for this kind of land management services? And with the farmers that we have seen descending on Berlin in a few weeks ago because of the German government asking them to do all kinds of additional environmental protection measures on the one side, at the same time farmers having to live with smaller and smaller margins in terms of food production prices that they're getting. So there's a huge debate out there how to manage this transition, as Jim was already talking about.
I think we need to really understand that consumer pressure for low food prices, government's interest in having large urban populations with low food prices combined with consolidation in the food sector does mean that very often farmers are being squeezed terribly in
absolutely.
Terms of the prices they get, and it's pretty
supermarkets have a lot of economic power.
Absolutely. So it doesn't matter whether you're a farmer in Europe, Australia or Africa, you know, very often you're getting squeezed.
Yeah, and what we've also seen analysis again in the EU food system, for example, but you know, a lot of price volatility at the farm gate and almost none on side of the consumers, meaning that basically the farmers carry all the risk of the price volatility versus the consumers, you know, get the bananas almost for the same price.
And is that basically because the supermarkets are just saying, we're not going to buy from you unless...
Not necessarily. I mean, that might be one of the reasons, but there's a lot of other reasons in terms of the overall incentive structures, you know, how risk is basically distributed along the system, pushed, as it looks like from first set of analyses that we're seeing, more towards the production end and none on the consumer side.
Well, and also because the farmer ends up with such a small proportion of the end price that a halving of the price for the farmer or a doubling of the price for the farmer ends up actually not having a very big impact on the end price that the consumer pays.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Yeah, I mean, these are massive challenges. I'd really like to end by asking you whether, in the light of all those challenges, you feel optimistic or pessimistic about the next 20, 30 years. Are we actually going to see around the world, with all the different governments there are, some of them dysfunctional, with all the different economic pressures, a lot of them coming from consumers who think more short-term than long-term, are we going to get the kind of coordinated action in response to systematic analysis that we need? Jim?
If we weren't optimistic about this, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. So yes, I have my moments of desperation about some of the issues we're facing in the world at the moment. But on the other hand, I also get incredibly encouraged by the people I work with. You know, whether it's the work that, you know, small women farmers are doing in a part of Africa, whether it's what I see happening with some businesses that are working together around the World Economic Forum, whether it's seeing that the UN Secretary General has called a whole food system summit to be held towards the end of next year. So I think there is a tremendous amount of momentum around these issues. I think there's a tremendous amount of innovation happening, and I think there's an increasing number of people really trying to get their heads around these issues. And I think we have many of the tools that we need to make it work. And my hope would be that some of the big issues we're seeing at the moment are starting to put enough pressure on us all that we're starting to realise actually change does have to happen, and then maybe it can go fairly quickly. But again, I guess we're sort of partly back in the land of the crystal ball gazing, you know, on what will really happen.
And right, but
all we can do is make a contribution.
We might be approaching a benign tipping point.
One can hope that we're approaching a benign tipping point.
Okay,
well, Monica. I think what we can definitely say is that there's quite a growing interest in the topic, and again the sense of urgency. I see that rising definitely. I was at the WEF recently, and there were the World Economic Forum recently. We had a session there on cultivated food systems, you know, and there was such an interest there of people, and there were so many sessions both on food and also on environmental issues that I had the feeling, okay, that the kind of the urgency, the sense of urgency is there. At the same time, I also see quite a lot of, you know, change in the youth. I mean, if we just think of the whole rise of changes in meat eating behaviors in the last 5 years in a very short time, all for environmental reasons, also more for health. I mean, it's a tremendous change in a really short time, and we see more and more local initiatives developing. I mean, even here in Oxford, you know, the Oxford Food Bank, Good Food Oxford, these are all initiatives that are doing an incredible amount of work where so many more people are becoming interested in this.
Yeah. And just yesterday around the Foresight for Food initiative, we had somebody call us from Switzerland saying, look, we're going to hold a whole sort of food gathering with local businesses to look at how our local area can become more sustainable in the way we're thinking about producing and eating food. Can you help?
So there are these local initiatives that I think it's both a mix between the, you know, top-down understanding that something needs to change. That's why the UN Food Summit next year is going to be really critical for this. And at the same time, having these bottom-up initiatives, because the change needs to be within the local context. I mean, it's not that we have the one-size-fits-all kind of... We know that from systems thinking, it doesn't quite work.
So organic.
It needs to come from initiatives of all the different geographical levels. And again, I think that... The momentum is there, and so I'm, same as Jim, hopeful that the changes are possible, because also we do have more and more of these tools available to help us, and approaches and methods and ideas. We just need to keep on deploying that, need to keep on at it. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the fun of the working together.
But, I mean, ultimately, I think we've also got to recognize essentially it's partly a political project. I mean, how do you mobilize the coalitions and the thinking to have influence in a political space to bring around that change? So when I think about the innovation that's needed, I often think about sort of three different aspects of the innovation. So one is the technical innovation. The other one is the institutional innovation. So how do you get the laws and the policies and the frameworks right? And then the third one is the sort of political or governance innovation you need for making decision making. And we've got to be thinking about drawing those three types of innovation together to push change along.
Well, thank you very much. That's been an extremely interesting discussion. I've learned a lot.
Thank you very much, Peter.
It's been a great pleasure. It's got us thinking as
exactly well. For new ideas in terms of research and all that. So thanks a lot.
Particularly the points around, you know, you're just talking a whole lot of naive stuff that doesn't really relate to the reality of how politics and systems work.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And let's hope your optimistic hopes turn out to be fulfilled. Thank you again.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
My thanks again to Monica and Jim for their time, and to all of you for listening to these bonus Future Makers episodes. If you've missed any of Season 2's previous conversations, from the politics of climate change with Caroline Lucas, to the role of institutions like the Bank of England with Governor Mark Carney, do go back and give them a listen, and let us know what you thought. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.